One of the things that's particularly pleasing about him producing Dave is that his poetry is a lot of fun. It's also very serious stuff. And I think that's a rare occasion in poetry in any language. So please help me welcome Dave Lee.
Samuel, thank you. All of you, thank you. This is a deep honor for me to be asked to be here for this. I'm pretty damn humbled by it, as a matter of fact. I'm going to do something I haven't done before. Who knows, may fall on its face, but we won't know the difference anyway, will we? I'm going to do a bit of a retrospective. I'm going to try to read from everything. I'm going to read from everything that Sam has published. I'm going to read a new poem from one that I hope he will as it comes along, and we'll just see how this thing goes. I've had two or three of you since I've come in here ask me for a poem. I haven't said no to anyone yet, but if anyone doesn't like them, I'm going to say don't blame me, that's Cheryl Van Dyke. All right, but sure, here we go. This is just a good opening poem, help to get the nerves to go down. And if you can't hear, let me know, okay? But the acoustics seem pretty good. Hello? Hello, Mr. Williamson, this is David Lee. I live in Paragona. During my morning run, I passed by your stock pens west of Paragona, and I saw that one of your cows, the black, white face, I think, seems to have calved during the night. I think around sunrise, the calf was still steaming, at least I think so. But the cow seems to be in some trouble. I think her uterus is prolapsed and she probably needs some help. I was running and I didn't stop and walk over to see. Instead, I turned around and came back and called you to let you know so you can go out and see if she needs help. Who's this? Is this church business? No, Wallace. I'm the guy who runs out by your stock pens every morning. You wave at me. Today I ran early and saw that you got a cow in trouble. She's an Angus Hereford cross. She's calved and her vagina has protruded. You ought to go out and check on her as soon as you can. Is this about selling Amway? Listen. God damn it. This morning in your west pen, the black volley dropped her calf and her ass is out down to her knee. She needs help. Oh, God damn, it's that two-year-old heifer. I didn't know she was that close. I got to go. Look, mister, whoever you are, you call back. Take and give my wife your name. I owe you, but I can't call now. I got to go. I sure thank you. I'll make it up to you someday, somehow. Bye. Well, we have a new book out. Been out on the road quite a lot with it this year. I've read from it for 6 months solid. I'm not going to exclusively read, but I'm going to turn to it right now because I'm familiar with it. And besides, I'm starting this off with my daughter's poems. I wrote this when she was 9. I've written her 85 love poems. That was her favorite poem. This is her second favorite poem. And she says it's because it reminds her the most of me, and it's called Ugly. So, there. This is from my town. The ugliest man in town was Rafael Martinez. He's kin to them Martinezes. I never did tell you people about it. Had them two twin boys hooked together on one leg. And this sister that grown this extra tit right up over her hip, they said. But they never did cut them two boys apart. They was born dead. So they took them and put them in a museum in a jar where you can go see them looking at you through the alcohol. But he wasn't born that way. It's one morning when he's herding sheep up above Sawmill Road, he woke up and he wished he wouldn't have. He couldn't stand up. The pain was so bad. And he knew he couldn't live with it. It's too far to town. Like a weasel inside him chewing, he said. He found his pistol and put it in his mouth and pulled. Bullet tore out his cheekbone, shot off half his ear, and never hit no brains at all. That was the only bullet he had left. He couldn't get to his rifle. So after he waited to die, and he finally didn't, he took out his knife and he cut his throat, but he didn't hit a vein. He stabbed himself, but the blade was turned wrong on the rib and bounced off. Stabbed himself higher and harder, hit his collarbone so it broke part of the knife blade off, stuck in the bone. He threw himself in the fire. He said that hurt too bad to stay. He had to roll out. His coals from last night melted his face on that part, burned off a hair on that side where it never did grow back, closed up one eye and cauterized his neck where it almost stopped bleeding. Said he could hear himself frying for somebody's breakfast, but he had to roll out. He couldn't stand it no more. Found a shoeing hammer. Took and hit himself as hard as he could with both hands on the handle between the eyes. Knocked him out so hard he should have starved to death before he woke up, but he didn't. Had a lump the size of an ostrich egg growing on his face. So he had one more idea. He tied a pigging rope on his feet and he drug himself. This mule he had, mean kicking bastard, crawled up on its back and tied his hands to his feet underneath that mule's belly. Said he never knew how that mule let him get on. He's hollering of the pain so when he moved, and that mule hated being unloaded. Being loaded, he had even untied him first. He could have kicked him on the mouth when he's laying there on his knees or run off. He figured that mule would have at least thrown him over his butt and kicked loose, caved maybe the rest of his head in. Mule turned and went to town. Got him there by afternoon, passed out. People who found him was scared to death. Seen that one side didn't have no face left. Blood all over that mule, like he had been swatting flies on him with an ice pick. They took him to the hospital, couldn't figure out what was wrong. Saw all them holes in him, burnt off spots, blood everywhere. When they went out to lay him straight, he'd scream like hell, and they couldn't understand a word of it. The only English he was speaking was Spanish. They couldn't wake him up enough to shift his gear. Tried to patch him up the best they could without it costing much. They knew there wasn't any insurance, and nobody wanted that mule. That night, they said, he sat up, hollering like a son of a bitch. Grabbed his privates like he'd pull it off. They'd taken him, given him a shot. By the next morning, he passed as big as the end of your thumb, this kidney stone. They said it turned his Gentile inside out. Never seen one that big before. He took and bored a hole in it and wore it for a necklace. I saw it many a time. My God, that man was ugly. About half a face with the eye shut on that side, half an ear, throat cut scar, and his arms blistered from his elbows to his hands where he laid in that fire, dent between his eyes, and a big white spot where his cheekbone used to be where that bullet come out. Wasn't one kid in town who'd stay on the same side of the road as he's walking on. Never bothered him a bit. He was as happy as a goose. And had about that many brains left. So, about a year before he died, he come in to the doctor again, all wadded up in a bunch. His kinsfolk brought him for the examination and the x-ray by then. Doctor said, "Oh, I got bad news for you." They said his face went just as white as a Nazarene preacher or a highway patrolman. Doctor says, "You got the cancer." Ralph Martinez almost fell off that chair. He started laughing and bawling, did that cross thing, says, "Oh, thank God, goddamn, thank God. I'm so afraid. It'd be the kidney stone again." He's so happy. They said it almost looked like that face would have busted like a balloon. He said he wasn't afraid of no cancer or dying because he had been there before. But with the kidney stone, it just wasn't no way to find out how not to be there when it happened, and that was too ugly for him to have to think about. An autobiographical poem. I did spend my first 3 years of college and seminary training, and I woke up one day and realized what I was about to become or was in the process of becoming, and got out for all the right reasons, I suppose. And this is looking back. Title of the poem is Preacher. I call this person in this poem a Baptist. If you are a Baptist, change him to a Presbyterian, or a Methodist, or an Episcopalian, or a Camelot. The only reason I call him a Baptist is because, A, I think most people recognize that as a religious term. B, I happen to live in Utah, and we simply do not have Baptists in Utah. We have Islam and his Baptists in Utah, and therefore it's just a neutral term there. But in 1956, the Baptists got a new preacher, the Reverend Pastor Brother Strahan from the Southern Tennessee Preacher School Seminary. He had a Bible they gave him for graduating, had about 40 ribbons marking his page number hanging out the back, every color you could imagine. After he'd been there for about a year, he'd still tell them how they didn't appreciate him enough because he was awarded them ribbons for being outstanding in his field. One day, Mrs. Boucher, who was old enough to not have to care no more, said after church, she wished to hell he'd go out and stand in his field some more. She'd had enough of him already. He'd preach, swinging that thing around like a Chinaman's kite. By the end of the sermon, he had took out ribbons, marking spots all worked up to give the invitation. He swung it so hard once it cut off the top of an incarnation in the pulpit flower pot. He loved to preach on how he got called by the Lord to be his servant when he's only 16 years old, met his lovely wife that same summer. My mama said she figured he's right. All boys that age get caught, some of them even on the telephone. But she thought the Lord got a wrong number that time. We all screwed up now and then. He had about 9 kids. Said it was the Lord's will. Oldest one, not even 12. His wife looked like an inner tube with about half its air in it. You'd hear in the grocery store, 2 aisles over, her feet drugged so she's wore out, not even 30, and known it was her before you saw her by the sound. Even if he got his preacher pay and a house and a car and his electric and water, with all them kids, he thought it wasn't enough to get by on. Every third Sunday, the sermon was on the collection plate and the bread on the water. He'd go around town asking all the business for a preacher discount. Wouldn't buy nothing in a store if they didn't mark it down for him, and they didn't. He'd make them sorry for it. He'd find some way to get it in one of his sermons. Whole church house would go somewhere else after that, whether they believed it or not. His kids got in the picture show half price and free meals at the school lunchroom and the ball games without paying because it was the Lord's will. So once he went to Leela's Cafe for supper with his whole family, stood there at the counter before he had sat down, said, how much is your menstrual discount to eat here? Customers listening to, waiting to pay, says, I need at least 20%. Leela said, why? She wasn't even a Baptist, but a Presbyter. Says, my family and I get discounts of because I am the Baptist Reverend of up to 1/2 at most places. One of the people eating there, Clovis Robinson, I think, says, yes, ma'am. That's a fact. He's a Baptist deacon. Had to back him up without no choice. Wasn't nothing she could do.
everybody waiting, watching to see. They'd all walk out. Leela said, "Sit down. I'll do my 20% one time." All them kids standing there with their mouths hanging open. Three of them didn't even have their breeches zipped up. He ordered tuna fish sandwiches and a glass of water for all them kids because that was the cheapest. Fried chicken for his wife because that was the most for the money. And told this waitress to bring him a steak to eat. "How do you want that cooked?" she said. "Scriptural," he said. She said, "What?" He said, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Leaned back, grinned, proud of himself, like he thought she ought to bring him a dish of ice cream for free for thinking that one up. Leela heard it. Hollered through the window from the cash register to the cook, the whole cafe listening. "Fix that preacher's kids hamburgers and French fries. Make his wife shrimps and white fish. Put him off a steak from the bottom of the pile. I'll pay the difference. How you want that steak?" Cook hollered. She says, "Scriptural. Burn that son of a bitch to hell." He never did come back here to eat again after that. It never hurt Leela's business, not even one bit. This is the oldest poem I'm going to read. This thing is half as old as I am. I wrote it about 12 years ago. This one was so, I don't even have the book. This one's from the Porcine Legacy, the first edition of the Canticles, and a request poem. We did a cleaned up version of this one this morning. I changed one letter of one word, I believe, along the way. John calls and says, "Dave," and I say hello, and I say, "Hello, John." He says, "Come down, Dave. You got to see what I bought." I say, "Fine. I'll be right there." And he says, "Bring Jan. I'll show her too." And I said, "Fine, John, I will." So Jan and I got in the car to go see what John bought. John bought 4 hogs. Starved half to death, bones out everywhere, snout sharp enough to root pine trees, and the longest damn legs I have ever seen. "What do you think?" says John. And I don't say anything. So he says, I says, "What do you think?" And I say, "Well, them's pretty good looking race hogs, John." He says, "What?" And I tell him about a place I heard of in Japan or California, because he's never been there, where they have a track and race hogs on Tuesday night. He says, "Do they pay much?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, so I heard, maybe 100 to win." He says, "God damn." I said, "Look, them hogs ought to be pretty good with them long legs and skinny bodies." And he says, "God damn." Jan's walked off, so I go to find her, but she's mad. Says I ought not to do that. I tell her I was just bullshitting. But when we come back, John's standing by the fence, throwing little pieces of feed all around that pen, making those hogs hurry from one place to the next. And when I get up close, he's smiling, and I can hear him whisper while he throws that feed, "Run, you skinny fuckers, run!" I suppose sort of in the same voice. We have a Sheltie. I'm from the South. I grew up not believing dogs are supposed to be inside the house. We have a Sheltie. All right. This is called House Dogs. I wrote this for my wife. And it has an epigraph from Alexander Pope's Rape of the Lock. "Not louder shrieks to pitying heaven are cast when husbands or when lap dogs breathe their last.
Ollie McDougal, when I sat down at the counter to have coffee, said he didn't want to talk about it. I seen he's down in the mouth. Said, where? He said, it ain't nothing to speak of. I let it go. Watched while he stirred his coffee without no sugar or milk in it with his spoon studying. Said finally, well, if it's any of your business, it's that goddamn feist my brother-in-law by marriage taken and give to my wife. She named Sweetie. And now that son of a bitch lives in the house. It's about ruined my whole life marriage. Done shot to hell and dog shit all over the yard. Now what am I supposed to do? B.L. Wayburn running coffee and cash register listening in said, it ain't nothing about all this I don't know. So if you curious, you just ask me. I done been married 3 times, had 9 dogs, 2 of them in the house by 2 women. I'll tell you now, free of charge, 2 things you can set your watch to and live a life by if you want. First, is a married woman can only love a thing if she can pity it and run over it. Which is why they let them things sit in their lap smelling them watching TV in the house whenever they scratch on the door to get in. And the second is what your daddy should have told you in the high school, that a woman's love is like morning dew, sparkles like a diamond in the goat's ass, and it might run on a red land on a red garden rose or a turd. It don't know the difference. You better make yourself a custom. She ever has to choose between you and that shit eater, you just as well get on down the gravel way kicking road apples. One of them might be duet. Remember, it can't necessarily help it. Her and it just likes to shine. So all you can do is scrape off your shoes, come on in, sit down, and try to outlive it and not get another. That dog is as permanent, as official as Judge Parker in his courthouse. Now, you want to stay married, you make you a compromise. Do it her way, and that's all there is to it.
That is my wife's favorite poem out of the new book.
It's the halfway point in the book.
Help me right here, said John. And I grasped the bottom rim. We lifted the barrel up into the pickup and then sat down on the tailgate. Hot. A warm canyon breeze spilled across the yellow grass. It was this one summer back home. I was young. About the time most kids getting out of school, I done quit. Old man Cummins had me helping him, lifting all this heavy weight on a wagon load. We made a tote, set in the shade to rest. He must have started remembering. Commenced to talking, says, summer clover, jingle, jangle. He done taken and put his hand in his pocket and pulled out the silver dollar. Looked at it like he never even seen it before. Smooth, so you couldn't even read the words on it. Man on the side rubbed off from being carried so long. It was meadow clover, all over stretching out green and yellow. I didn't say nothing. He talked. Said, I was 17. They come in wagons, putting on gypsy carnivals. Whole town wanted them to go on, knowing they'd steal what all was loose. Everybody came down to the tent that night anyway. They paid me $1 to water horses. I worked all afternoon hard. I was 17.
for a dollar. She had eyes that laughed. Same color as them fancy shoes. Laughed like silver baubles on a red and blue velvet dress, color of midnight.
Even in the dark,
I seen me looking back from those black eyes. I wasn't scared. She showed me slow, easy, the whole field of yellow clover, bells on her shoes, real soft, jingle, jangle. So many nights I can't sleep. Smell comes in the window after me. When my wife's alive times, I lean the whole night beside her, shaking, awake, all that dark, tearing holes in me. Nothing I could do but stay there and listen for the sound of silver wind bells. Kids in the next room sleeping. Nobody could hear it or smell it but me. Summer clover. Jingle, jangle. He sat there, staring at that money in his hand, almost like he's talking to it, like he done forgotten I was there too. Never said no more. Closed his eyes, put it in his pocket. I could tell he was smelling the summer grass. It was all over for then.
So, let's take this pig feed up to the pens and we'll be done.
Lifting it down won't be as hard as getting it in. Second half of anything's always easier than the first.
And from the Canticles, a poem that begins with an epigraph. It is probably the first piece of poetry I ever wrote in my life, and I did it in the seventh grade. Our teacher was Mrs. Carpenter. She gave us a poetry assignment to go, as we say in Texas, to the library and to look through books and find a poem, copy it down on a piece of paper, make a change in it, put our name on it, and call it our poem. That's poetry. And I wrote the following. Hell hath no fury like a sow with pigs. And she gave me an F and said I did not understand the assignment. It was poetry and mine didn't rhyme, but I could redo it. And you know something? I took the F. And I've always begun this poem by dedicating it to Miss Carpenter. The title of the poem is Mean. So, Miss Carpenter, wherever you are, it's for you. Pretty soon now, I said, and John nods his head, watching. So I said, I see she's broke the sack. There's water. His head goes up and down again, but he didn't say anything. So we both stand and watch John's big white sow back in her shed while she breathes easy. 700 pounds sprawled across yellow straw. Finally, John says, any time now. And I nod my head this time. He says, yep, just any time. But the only thing we can do is watch. So we stand and wait and watch John's white sow labor. And John lights a cigarette to help the time go by while we watch. Last time, says John, she went crazier than hell. I had her in that pen with a wood floor, and I put in a lamp for the cold,
and she's half done, got up, and that mean son of a bitch, she went over and bit that electric wire. Must have shocked her or something. She went like a crazy woman to banging her head on the walls and the floor and hollered like an elephant shot in the butt with buckshot. She tore hell out of that pen and had two more pigs while she's standing up and never knew it. She acted like she's blind and couldn't see nothing. I had to get them pigs out with a rake or she'd have stomped on them all. And she jerked that rake right out of my hand twice. I had to get it back with a stick so I could get them pigs out or they'd all be dead. I got all but one that she killed, and she finally went over and laid down to have her pigs, but every time one of them I had out, squoat, she'd jump up and go crazy again. I had to put all them pigs in the front of my pickup all night to make her be still, and that light never did work right after that. She burnt it. I says, "How come you keep her, John? She's too big, mean." John looks at me like I was nuts or something and says, "Because she had 12 pigs and raised all but one more besides the one she stomped on. That's why, wouldn't you?" But I didn't say anything. John White Sal was too mean for me. I would have sold her to John if she was mine. But she wasn't. She was already his, so I didn't have to. "John," I says after a while, because she wouldn't pig, "I'll bet that sow's got a pig stuck breech and it won't come." But John looks over at his pickup and doesn't say anything. So I say, "If she does, and if it doesn't come, it could kill her and all them pigs too, don't you think?" But he keeps looking at his pickup, so I say, "I don't know. Course, but that might be it. She's been in labor a long time. She broke her water before I got here. I saw the last of the wet when I came, but I don't know. She's not my sow. It might not be that," but John says real low, "She towed Carl out of the pen that time he got in and tried to climb out after him. She'd have killed him if she got to him." So I decided I wouldn't say anything else. She was John's sow. He would know what to do. "Why don't you get in there and look?" John said. "You know more about that than I do." And I said, "No, I don't, John. And I have to be getting home pretty soon. Jan will be getting worried, and I hate to keep her up." John says, "Dave, I'll give you $25 if you go get that pig out." I said, "John, I am not getting in that sow with that pen with that sow for $100. John says, "Okay, $15 cash." I said, "No, John, I'm not going to get in there with her for $1,000. John said, "I'll give you a pig." I said, "I wouldn't do it for the sow and all the pigs loaded up to take to the auction." John says, "Okay, a live pig. You can pick it." I said, "No, and I meant it, not for all his pigs." And I acted like I was getting ready to leave. I wasn't. I wanted to see how it came out, but I wasn't getting in that pen. So John goddamned me and said I was a sissy, and I didn't say anything because John was right. John says, "If I get in there, will you come and hold the lantern in the door so I can see?" And I said, "Yes." Because the sow was in bad shape by then. We could see that, and she had to have help. But I said, "John, if she comes after me, I'm getting out, and I'm not going to worry about that lantern getting with me. It may get busted." John says, "If she gets up, you just make sure she don't get you and that lantern both if you're in my way." I said, "Okay, because I know there's no way John can get out of that pen before me." I wasn't worried about that. So I said, "Where's the lantern?" John says, "Over here." We go to his pickup for the lantern. John gives me the lantern and some clean rags to hold. And then he gets in his jockey box and he pulls out a pistol. I say, "What's that?" He says, Well, it's a gun. I say, oh, I see. And he says, I ain't getting in there with her without no gun. My mama didn't raise no idiots. And if I need this, I want to have it with me. That's why. And he put it in his coat pocket. And I didn't say anything because she was John's sow, not mine. John climbed in the pen, and I followed. He went in the shed with the sow, but I stayed in the door while he moved around behind her slow to see what she'd do. She had her eyes closed, and she breathed hard because she hurt so bad. And I shined the light in so John could see. John knelt behind her and touched her, but she didn't move. So he rolled up his sleeve and started in to see what was wrong. Breech, I whispered. And he nodded, so I was right. And John went in to try to get it out. John whispers, hold still, I can't see. I said, who? And he said, you. I saw the lantern was shaking. I was scared. So I held it with both hands and it was still. John twisted his hand inside the sow. He said, I got it. I'm going to take it out now. He started pulling his arm back and the pig came out and it was Breech. Got it, I said. John said, yes, give me a rag. And I leaned in to hand him a towel. And the pig wiggled in his hand. John tried to grab its mouth, but the pig squealed in his hand. God damn you, John screamed. The white sow jumped up and bellowed so loud the tin roof on that shed shook. Jerked around toward John. I stood there like Lot's wife shining that light in. John screams, God damn you again, and jumps back against the back wall of that shed. Hits it so hard it should have come down. Holding the pig tight against his chest, the sow roars at him. The muscles in her body standing out, all the hair standing straight up. I think, drop that pig, John, but I can't say anything. I'm frozen, holding the lantern in the door, the sow roaring and John screaming. And then he tears at his pocket and pulls out that pistol. God damn you, he says, you get away from me, you son of a bitch. That sow barks loud like a mad dog the size of a Jersey cow. John points that pistol at her head and it shakes like an aspen limb in springtime. God damn you! And she screams again. Snick, 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 snick. I see the empty cylinder turn. As John pulls the trigger, I taste powder in my mouth. Drop it, I hear somebody say. John keeps pulling that trigger, yelling, God damn you, sow roars. And her shoulders bunch up in a knot. She's so mad, she's slobbering. Drop it, I yell again. And John looks at me, his eyes wide as hubcaps. Drop that pig, I scream. And I see John's hand loosen, and the pig falls to the ground. But he keeps pulling that trigger, snick, 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 snick. Pig hits on its back and lays there. And the sow lowers her head and looks at it, but keeps on grunting loud and fast and mean. John stops pulling the trigger, but keeps the pistol pointed at her head. And the pig gets up and starts moving. The sow quits grunting and sniffs it and then looks at John and barks again. John pulls that trigger again, but he can't say anything anymore. And the sow turns and lays down and grunts, and another pig pops out. And the first pig finds her and tries to find a tip, and the second pig squirms and shakes its head and tries to clear its nose. And John stands with the pistol pointed at the sow, and I stand holding the lantern, and the sow grunts to her pigs just like, we're not even there, nothing happened. And I say, John. John points the pistol at me. And I say, get out of there, John. And he says, where? And I say, get out of that shed, John, before she gets up. And John says, who? And I say, get out of there, John. And John looks at the sow and points the pistol back at her, and then he starts sliding around the wall. And we get out of John's mean white sow's pen. John's shaking so hard, he can't light a cigarette. So I do it, but he drops it on the floorboard. So I pick it up and put it in his mouth, and he smokes. I say, "You got a beer?" He said, "In the back, I think." So I take the lantern and look, and he has some hid in his junk in the bed. I get it, and for a long time we drink beer and don't say anything. And I see that my hands are shaking, so the beer foams out the top of my can, so I drink three fast so it won't. I don't know if he ever finished his. Finally, I said, "John, I wouldn't have a pig like that. I would get rid of her if she's mine. She's just too mean. She's going to kill somebody someday." John, staring straight ahead through the window, the muscles in his face still drawn tight, he says, "God damn it. That's too bad." I say, "Well, you can't help it. Some of them go mean." He said, "She was a good sow." I says, "She's okay now." John says, "But it was her or me." I say, "It's okay." He sips his beer, then sets it up on the dashboard and leans back. I see tears in his eyes, and he's still staring straight ahead through that windshield. "She was a good sow," he says, "even if she was mean. God damn it. I hated having to shoot her like that." And I looked out the window, and I didn't say anything. She was John's sow, not mine. "I can't get the top screwed off this beer. Can you help? That's the only thing I miss this finger for. I got cut off. I just haven't got no grip to twist off these beer lids. They put them on too tight for me now. There was this guy I heard about who was a miner or trapper or something. Anyways, he lived alone up in the hills, and he got his finger chopped off. I guess he's a trapper and got it caught. That happens now and then. So he just picked up his finger and stuck it in his pocket. Went on home. When he got there, he took out his needle and thread, and he sewed that finger back on. Didn't work. 2 or 3 weeks later, it all swole up green, and the finger fell off. So he built a fire in the stove, and then he held the stump against it till he burned all that green poison out. I think a feller would have to be pretty much of a man to do that." "I knew this other guy who was loading up the sow hog, and she wouldn't go, so he's trying to waller her into the truck, and he grabs her by the tail with one hand and the ear with the other. She's screaming like hell the whole time, and him getting pretty pissed off, so he does this a time or two, and then he grabs her again, but gets the one hand in her mouth, so he feels something pinch. He pulls back his hand. His finger's gone. That damn sow's bit him off. He looked all round. He didn't find that finger nowhere. He figured that sow swallowed it. I don't like to talk about how I lost mine. Still bothers me some. Maybe I'm just too drunk. I started thinking about it.
Well, this all happened before I went to work for the electric company. I was younger, hired on for the oil. Oh, I made good money, and it wasn't bad work. I don't think I'd do it again. Anyways, was in Texas, up on that panhandle. Had a rig drilling about 8 mile out of town. Would work 36 on and 12 off, at least I would, because I could make so much that way. I'd run chain a while and then run crow nest. Never made no difference. I was just after the paycheck on Fridays. I'd do about anything they wanted as long as the money kept coming in. They seemed to like that. So anyways, we was down over a mile, damn near 7,000 foot. And we knew that oil was right there. We had to be coming through anytime. You just get the feeling it's gonna blow. So here comes the foreman, because we had to send for him, because he has to assess when we can cap off to get ready for that last push through, so we don't all blow to hell and maybe catch fire. That foreman, he is so goddamn drunk he can't tell shit from dog puke. He starts to raising all kind of hell, saying, "We brought that motherfucking oil for 2 weeks. Nobody paid you to think. That's what I'm, by God, paid for. You just drill till I say stop. Then you just ask how long, and that's all. So you just get back to goddamn work. Stop trying to sit around fucking off." He left. We're so mad we couldn't see straight. For a man to talk to us that way, whether he's drunk or not, didn't matter. So we set the bit back down in the night and let her go. What the hell? About midnight, crew boss, he says to me, "John, you go up to the crow nest. We lifting that pipe out. I ain't getting blowed up for nobody." And that was fine by me. We was all getting scared to where we was just working, not saying nothing, just thinking about how long for morning or till we got off. It's funny how you think the day will take the being scared away. It never really does. Anyways, I climbed up Derek to the top and was getting ready to pull that pipe out, when all of a sudden the whole thing starts to shaking where I'm about to get slung off, and I can hear crew boss yelling, "Get down! Get down! This fucker's gonna blow!" By God, I burnt the palms off my hands coming down. I slid the wire guy rope to the platform and then jumped off on the ground. The rest of the crew's already running ahead. So as I try to catch up, and I can hear that big son of a bitch touch off, go boom, right behind me, and caught on fire. It blew me down on the ground and started me burning. By God, I was scared. I jumped up and started running, and I would have burned to death if this man hadn't grabbed me and thrown me down in the ditch and put out the fire in my clothes. So as we look, and that whole rig's burning, and we can see two guys from the crews laying between us and the rig, burning up. And we know they're dead. And the rest of us is burnt bad, where we might die. Crew boss, he takes off running into the fire. We can see he's going to try to bring the pickup out. He goes to it, and he grabs the door handle. And it's so hot, part of his hand sticks to the door. And it just comes off, but he gets in, and somehow he gets that damn truck started and drives out of that fire. I won't never know how. All the wires was burnt up. It was so hot that truck's paint was all scorched off the wheel. You couldn't even tell what kind of a truck it was. And he brings it to us, and we get in,
I'm burnt so bad, they had to put me in the back, and I'm laying in this feller's lap who put out the fire in my clothes, and we pull out of there, driving like hell to get to town, and by then, the fire was so hot, it burnt up the whole goddamn rig. There wasn't nothing left, and I seen it bend over, just like it was plastic. I wanted to pass out so bad I couldn't stand it, but I didn't. I just laid there and felt it all and saw it all. So we're going to town as fast as we can go, and we pass this law. And he turns on his red light and chases us till he gets close to sea, and then he pulls ahead and leads us through town about 90 mile an hour to the hospital, where he jumps out and runs over and opens the door, and he just puked like hell. Three up front was already dead, two of them stuck together, this burnt so bad, and the crew boss, his hand was off and he didn't have no face left. How he drove, God knows, I don't. And there was only one other still alive, and he died that night. So then they come to get us out of the back, and they started to lift me out, and I said, get him first. He saved my life. And the man said, it's too late. He's done dead. And I was laying in his lap. The only two that made it was me and the crew boss. He was in the hospital for 96 days. I was in for 104. A week and a day more. I remember, because he come to see me when they let him out. He was burnt so bad, I couldn't tell who he was till he said something. He asked if I was okay. I said yes. We just looked at each other for a minute. Then he walked off. I said, be seeing you. He just waved. 3 days later, he drove his car into a bridge and killed himself. They buried him exactly 1 week after they let him out. And then they let me out the next day after his funeral was over. I have no bad scars left to show. My legs is burnt good. I still feel it. I get cold. I have to wear them long underwears all year long on my legs. And my hands so thin they bleed easy. My skin's about as thick as a cigarette paper. I don't have no feelings in my face, but I'm lucky, I guess. All the rest is dead, except me. I went back to work for the oil the next day because I didn't have nothing else to do. They put me on chain, wrapping the pipes. That's when I done it. I hadn't been working an hour when this fellow on the other side threw his chain, and I felt it hurt. So I finished and I took off my glove and finger stayed in. I says, well, you son of a bitch, you done cut my finger off. I don't think he heard. He didn't say nothing. Well, I'd had it. I went to the man and said, that's it. Pay me off. Oh, he tried to get me to stay on, but I'd lost the taste. Didn't care no more. After that, I went down south and got my stomach cut out. And I come here to die. This is a pretty place. I didn't have nothing better. Every day, Laverne packed me a lunch. I'd draw her a map of where I'd be if I didn't make it home. I was weak. I couldn't hardly stand. I'd drive up in the hills where I'd take my clothes off and let the sun shine only where the muscles wouldn't heal up, on my stomach where I'd been burned, there was just ugly skin there you could see through. I only weighed 96 pounds, and I'd lay on a quilt and look back to the valley and just wait to be dead and have it done. You know, by God, I guess I'd still be laying up there waiting. Except after a while, Laverne, she went and bought these two hogs for me. She knew it like that. I got to coming down early to feed them. When I was up there, I'd get to thinking about the market and making money. I got so excited, I come down one day early and went to looking for a boar to go get a herd started, and the next day I forgot to go up and die. And pretty soon I about quit thinking about it altogether. It just don't take much to keep some people going. And that gets us about to here, which is nearly home. Time for one last beer. They say God takes special care of children and idiots. I guess he's always been looking out for me. By God, I'll always remember them times. They was good times for the most part, but I do hope to Christ they don't never, ever come back.
Walk out the front doors, just turn about and kind of wander in that direction.